Heritage 105 Radio.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women. We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results.
I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe.
And we produce and present Women Making Waves.
In this edition of Women Making Waves, we meet Dr. Priyanka Joshi, who is on the Vogue 25 list of the most influential women in the UK. During her PhD, Priyanka developed a small molecule library to target irregular proteins present in diseases such as Alzheimer's.
Joanna Bromwich went on holiday to the Gambia and found a school where children didn't have proper toilet facilities. Moved by their plight, she funded a new toilet block and is now very involved in raising money for the Bantamba project.
And we're looking at lifestyle, things to do in your spare time. We spoke to Johnny Moore, who runs Unhurried Conversations, a great way to chill out with interesting people.
That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves.
Linda, when I go on holiday, I want to go and lie down and get on and have a drink of wine.
You spend your life doing that, though, really, don't
you? I do,
yes. It's not a holiday at all.
Yes, okay. You found me out, but come on. What about this lady, Joanna Bromwich? She sounds amazing.
Yeah, she said to me, I don't like to go to the same place twice. That's one of the kind of rules about going on holiday. And when they go, they don't want to sit on a beach. They want to go out and explore and find out what's really going on under the surface, which is a great thing to do.
I think really an amazing to have such an inquisitive mind.
It is. It's very, very good. So she did this before she was going to the Gambia. She searched, I can't remember which site she went on, but she searched for things to do. And she ran into this lady who is out there, Sandy Sanyang, and she's out there running this project. And she said, well, come and look at my nursery school. So off she went and she did that. And she found one toilet with hundreds of kids, and it was like a long drop toilet, you know, with no hygiene whatsoever. So she decided to fund the building of a toilet block. And that's how it all started. She's now involved in the committees out there, and she said she's been back a couple of times. So she is actually breaking her own rules about going to the same place twice.
Now, that's a good point, actually. Yes.
Yeah. But I think she goes to other places as well. But she's very involved in the projects out there. And in fact, Neil Whiteside and I went and looked at this project. That's on a separate programme altogether that will be broadcasting. But very, very interesting place, very, very interesting people.
And here is Joanna Bromwich talking to Linda Ness.
I'm speaking to Joanna Bromwich, who is on the committee of Goal for the Gambia. Joanna, tell me about this charity.
We're a quite a small charity set up by one lady, Sandy Sanyang, with a small group of committee members and volunteers. And what we do is we support education and learning and different rural projects and areas over in the Gambia.
So tell me about education in the Gambia. Do all children have to go to school like they do here?
Ideally, yes. However, the reality is that there is a cost affiliated to going to school, and actually sometimes if the family can't afford that cost, it is the education that will get cut first, sadly.
I can imagine, because even if it's a small amount, if you've got nothing, a small amount is still too much, isn't it?
Absolutely. And also they have several children, so it all adds up.
It will. Tell me first of all about Sandy. How did she get started with this?
Well, I met Sandy back in 2012. So my husband and I just decided we wanted a bit of winter sun, found a holiday where there was sunshine involved. Obviously the Gambia in October, pretty nice weather. Historically, I really don't like going somewhere and not seeing the real country. So we got in touch with Sandy via TripAdvisor, just at looking into visiting a local school. And it kind of escalated from there. Sandy invited us to go and visit a school with her. And then my friends at work got involved. And before we knew it, we had two suitcases full of educational supplies to take with us. And it kind of went from there, really.
So it was just from a holiday and you just got in touch with somebody who was local. Are you involved in schools then yourself? Are you a teacher? teacher?
No, not at all. I really like to see a country when you visit. I really like to see the reality. I've been on Thomas Cook tours and that side of things before, and I don't think you see...
It's not quite the same, is it?
Not at all.
So you actually got in touch with her directly then?
Yeah, I just put a little note out on TripAdvisor asking if anyone could give me any advice about visiting a school. Sandy got in touch from there. So we kind of had a conversation online. Then I booked a visit with her, and then they came and picked us up when we were in the Gambia and took us out to one of their projects.
That is amazing, actually. Yeah. More of us should be doing things like that when we go on holiday, I think. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And in reality as well, the Thomas Cook trip would have cost us £100. The trip with Sandy cost us about £15. And we actually got to see
what was really going on, rather than the glossy version that you will tend to get on these trips. So what are you actually doing in those schools out there?
Well, the first school that Sandy started to help, they approached her purely because they didn't have any pencils or pens to take exams. So when Sandy went to visit the school, there was nothing really there in terms of supplies. It was very basic buildings. So she got involved by supplying some supplies. And then it kind of escalated as well, where people went to visit, like myself and my husband, raised some money. So within that one school, we've rebuilt the classrooms, the nursery, toilets. We've funded a whole new nursery block with a play area and swings.
So you're fundraising over here in order to send money across there?
Yes, yeah. So we fundraise here, and also a lot of it is done by visitors, such as my husband and myself. So if people want to visit, they'll tend to go out, see a project in action, come home and get involved from there.
So you've really picked this up then. This has started quite fancy seeing the locals in Gambia, but now you're really involved.
Yeah, really involved. And it kind of all escalated from the one school we saw. So it's kind of heartbreaking when you go out there in some ways. So the school we went to see was very basic. There was just, you know, a deep well that was completely uncovered, where three-year-olds were hanging over with a cup. The nursery block was so small. They had 70 children packed into this tiny room. Probably not a lot bigger than your office.
70 children?
70 little toddlers, where quite often they would pass out or they would be asleep on their desk because it's so hot, obviously.
For people that don't know what the size of Cambridge 105, it's not that huge.
No. And actually, this is on the generous side for what they were in.
I can't even imagine 70 people of any size being in here.
So it was quite an eye-opener for us. And then we looked at the toilet block. And at that point, there were 400 children in the school. They had three toilets. The roof had come off the toilets. They're long drop toilets. The floor moved. The doors didn't shut. And that was for all of the children, boys and girls. And it kind of resonated with me that I think all children should be able to go to the toilet.
Yes.
It's
a very basic thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in the rainy season, you should be able to go to the toilet in a clean area.
Yeah.
So after we visited, we then went to visit a local family that we had lunch with. So we were talking to them and obviously met the villagers. And I guess we came away thinking, what can we do? We're two people, but what can we do? And our birthdays come at Christmas. So this was October. My husband and I, we both have birthdays in December and then obviously Christmas. So we just decided, let's raise money. Let's set a fundraising page up. To see if we could raise £800 for a toilet block. It kind of escalated, and before we knew it, we had £3,000.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And that was on Just Giving or one of these sites?
Yeah, on the Virgin site, and we're lucky that we've got some really great friends. We had a £500 anonymous donation from somewhere, and my work are amazing. They really got involved and behind this. So, yeah, we kind of raised enough for the toilets and a bit more.
Are these built now? Are they?
Yes,
have you visited,
they were. Yeah,
visited the toilets.
we weren't ever planning to go back. Actually, we're not really people that go to the same place over and over again. But once they were built, and we saw some pictures, we decided, let's go back, have a look. And that visit then turned into us being invited to join the committee, which turned into us going back every year ever since.
So now you go to the same place every year.
Pretty much, yeah.
But I guess it's not a holiday anymore, because you will be working when you're out there.
It's a mixture. I'd love to say it is, you know, it's work, but it's a beautiful place for holiday. It's got lovely beaches. We have a really wonderful time when we're there. And yes, we still go and visit the projects that we're supporting, and we do go meet everybody. And one of the things we love when we do is we run beach days. A beach day is basically the opportunity for children to have a day out. They don't have days out. It's not like here where if the weather's nice, we'll go to the seaside.
Oh, yes. Everyone's spoiled rotten here, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, there's no transportation, there's no money to do that. So one of the things that we've implemented is every year group in the schools that we look after, at that point they get to have this beach day. So the idea is every child, by the time they've gone through school, have had at least one beach day. And we take about 35, 40 children to the beach for the day.
Just for a day of fun.
Yeah, a pure day of fun. And we have cooks from the local village, so they get cooked two meals, which are big meals for them. They have sweets and treats and different juices, and they play games and they get to go in the sea. So it's amazing.
That must be a day that they'll remember for years and years, all their lives probably, actually.
Absolutely. And actually for us, it's just amazing to see. They turn up a bit quiet, a bit kind of unsure, and by the end of the day, they're just shrieking and running. And
like children.
Yeah, completely. And they really learn quickly. So one of the things I've learned quite quickly is never start a water fight. Never, ever. And the one thing I learnt this year is don't start a seaweed fight.
Did you come off worse?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Dear, Joanna.
Started with two little girls, and then I just heard Sandy say, I'd run if I was you. And I turned around, there were 30 children.
Fantastic, though. Having great fun. What do the schools still need? Obviously, you've sorted out the toilet situation, but I'm assuming it's just never ending, really.
It is ongoing. So, and one of the things that happened to us last year is we'd set both the schools up and we were doing really well. And then we had really awful weather, which meant the roof was taken off of all of the school building.
Oof.
Yeah, it's quite difficult. And actually, the roofing is one of the most expensive parts of building out there. So we had to then fundraise for the new roof. It is ongoing. I mean, obviously, the school gets bigger all the time and there's more children. One of the things we do need are educational supplies, so pencils,
just
pens.
Simple as that. Just pencils,
really simple.
Pens,
yeah, chalk,
notebooks.
Blackboard paint. Obviously, it's all blackboards and chalk out there still. There's no electricity in the schools generally, so it is all the basic stuff. School uniform. Sometimes, and one of the major things is school, is sponsorship for the children that go to school.
Oh, how would people do that then?
The way we work it is it's a monthly donation, so it all goes through our site, it all goes through the gift aid as well, so it's £5 a month ongoing.
£5 a month will sponsor a child out there.
Yeah.
And that's nothing, is it?
Not at all. And that includes their school fees, it goes towards a uniform, a book bag. And everything that goes with that for that year. So £60 a year.
And do you sponsor a particular child? Do you know who this child is? Or is it a generic kind of £5 and we know that sponsors a child?
I think you do know them because you receive a school report and you're told about them. We have caseworkers that work for us. So what they do is they visit all of the children when it comes to school report time, and they visit them sporadically through the year as well. So you'll get something personalised from your child. I guess probably some of my friends that have got sponsored children get a little bit more interaction in terms of when I go, I take a parcel to the family.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually meet their families. Quite often they donate rice, so I get to give rice to the families and I get to see the children every year, which is amazing.
It must be quite expensive for you, though, paying for all of this stuff going across in the plane with you.
Yes, yeah, we do always have quite a lot of luggage. So this year we had 105 kilograms of luggage.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And a three-year-old, so that was fun. But we do ship out, so it's probably about £9 or £10 for a box that we ship out on probably a monthly, two-monthly basis.
Neil Whiteside and I are going to be going out to the Gambia to look at your project and another project as well. We're going out quite soon.
Yeah.
What should we take with us when we're going out there?
I would take school supplies. So pencils and pens, colouring pencils, colouring books. The stuff that children like, I would definitely take out for the school. If you're visiting the village, hopefully, which you will after, mm-hmm. balloons.
Balloons?
Yeah, balloons. Hours of fun. You don't even have to blow it up and tie it. They'll just play with balloons for
I'm kind of assuming these children don't have a lot of toys.
They don't have any toys, really, no.
They don't have anything?
No.
If anyone wants to get in touch with you and find out more about this, how would they go about that?
We have a Facebook page, so you can find us on the Facebook page at Goal for the Gambia. You can message from there. We are good at getting back, but obviously bear in mind we're small, so it may take us a few days to come back. Or alternatively, you can email myself and I can share information that way as well.
Thank you very much for telling us about the work that you're doing, Joanna.
And that was Linda Ness talking to Joanna Bromage.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
We wanted to find interesting pastimes and pursuits. And the first thing that we found was quite an interesting concept, actually, about unhurried conversations. It's run by someone called Johnny Moore. He started this idea of just getting together and people not interrupting you, you know, being able to speak for a period of time until you were finished, uninterrupted and in an unhurried manner.
It's an art, isn't it, sometimes? It's just
the art of conversation.
The art of conversation, to sit back and listen and not always have an answer before you actually hear that person speak.
Exactly.
Because you might change your mind. Mm-hmm. As we're doing now, Linda.
As we are.
We're very good at that. And so we'll be listening now to Johnny Moore, who is going to be talking to Linda Ness.
If you are the only person speaking, you really do realise that you are being listened to, not just by one person, but by several people. And I think that experience of really being heard is quite rare for us, and I think it's very calming.
I'm joined by Johnny Moore, who will be talking about unhurried conversations. In this rushed world, I thought that this was an interesting idea, so I thought I'd get Johnny in for Women Making Waves to tell us all about it. Hi, Johnny.
Hello.
So tell me all about unhurried, because I believe, and this is my words, not yours, that you are the mastermind behind this idea.
I guess I'm the one to blame. I'm the one who started it. Its origins are in a conversation I had with a friend of mine from Cambridge called Anthony Quinn, and we're both fans of improv theatre. We like watching it and we occasionally perform it. And we were having a conversation about what we loved about it, but we also found ourselves talking about when it doesn't work, which is actually quite excruciating either to watch or to perform. And it was Anthony who said that he realised that the performances that didn't work for him were when they were rushed. And in a rushed improv theatre performance, the actors sort of trip over each other. Or you get scenes in which there are too many ideas building into a slightly frantic
puzzle. Yeah, and confusing, yes.
Yeah, so you end up with a scene that started out as a harmless conversation between two decorators. By the end is travelling to Mars on marshmallow motorbikes, as I put it. So he said he thought good improv was unhurried. And almost as soon as he said the word, both of us realised that actually had a lot of power for us. And we started talking about how we thought unhurried would be a really useful quality to strive for in life and in work. And that conversation stayed with us. We kept on having it. And I realised that it reminded me of a conversation process that's been around for millennia, basically, used in ancient tribes to have conversations where they use something they call a talking stick or a talking piece. And that means if you're holding this talking stick, you speak for as long as you wish. And when you finish, you put the stick down and someone else picks it up and speaks, and means that no one ever interrupts anyone. And I've used it occasionally before. And I thought, you know, it would be quite fun to retake that ancient ritual and bring it to the modern world and call it an unhurried conversation. Mm-hmm. So we started one in Cambridge as an experiment. I think the first one, we invited a few friends and rented a room and did it. And it was very satisfying. And then I decided to put it on Meetup. Which is this website where it's easy to form groups to stage events. And we found a good location and we got in the habit of hosting it roughly twice a month. And to begin with, sometimes it was just Anthony and me sitting there. It was quite funny because we'd look at each other and realise we were both a little bit disappointed that more people hadn't come. But then we said, but that's fine, there's no rush. This doesn't need to build fast. We can have an unhurried conversation. So I think one time we literally did, just the two of us. But gradually word spread and people started to find out about it. And I think now each time anywhere between maybe 7 or 8 and sometimes 14, 15 people, occasionally 20, show up in this coffee shop of a weekday morning, and we use this simple talking piece process to have
so
an unhurried conversation.
So have you got the talking stick then? Is that what you use?
So I actually quite deliberately don't have a big ancient ceremonial significant object. As some people do, I don't have the ancient stone that gives us power. I actually really aim to use the most mundane object I can find, a sugar bowl or a menu card in the coffee shop, because I don't want to invest the object with magical properties. The magic is in us. It's in the human beings. Mm-hmm. So I think the more ordinary the object is, the better.
I can think of people I know that if they had free rein to talk, it would be pretty awful. Does that sometimes happen? You're allowed to say that.
You're let me reassure you, Linda, you are certainly not the only person who harbours that fear. Many people coming for the first time are secretly thinking that might be the case. I nearly always get a laugh when I say in my introduction to the conversation, you might be thinking, what happens if someone grabs this menu and talks for an hour and a half? It has never, ever happened. It's never come close to happening in my experience. But I say, if it did, I would choose to relax. Imagine that I'd paid money to come to an Alan Bennett monologue and see if I could enjoy the performance. And I suppose what I'm getting at, I think for me personally, why I feel that this is such a personal project for me, is that I see it as my work to practice being unhurried in response to stress. Mm-hmm. So if someone talks an hour and a half, well, I have a choice to make and I can choose to not hurry and be relaxed about it. And then there's a kind of almost sort of spiritual logic. As soon as you stop worrying about it, you reduce the odds of it happening.
That's strange, really, but I guess it's true. And I guess people might sense, if they were rambling on a bit too much, they might sense by the faces around them, potentially.
I think one
they
of the
glaze over and fall asleep.
I think although it seems like a very simple process, some very, very powerful things happen that are different from our normal everyday lives. And one is that if you are the only person speaking, you really do realise that you are being listened to. Not just by one person, but by several people. Mm-hmm. And I think that experience of really being heard is actually quite rare for us. And I think it's very calming. And I think that means that people who might otherwise be very repetitive and go on at great length are calmed and don't.
And focus.
And they're aware of their own voice. They sense that they're being heard. And they almost catch themselves if they're being repetitive, and mm-hmm. they become more conscious of their speech, and they feel the power of their speech. And in my experience, that makes them more eloquent, less repetitive, and much less likely to go on and on and on.
Yeah, I like this idea. Now, the conversation itself, do you start it off with an idea, or do you just kind of go open floor, first person, bang?
I always do an introduction where I remind everyone of the rules, because usually there's at least one newcomer. Most often we don't have a set theme, or I say, in effect, the theme is whatever is on your mind. And that means that we might have several different things raised by different people, because we don't require people to join in on what the previous person said. If the first person talks about, let's say, for example, Brexit.
Mm-hmm. I wondered if that was going to be mentioned.
Well, the next person is welcome to talk about their cat, if that's what they would like. Mm-hmm. Cats come up quite often. So normally I don't have a theme. And this has been another way in which it's been a fantastic education to me, because I earn my living as a facilitator. So my job is to organise meetings. And of course, in my professional work, it would be taken as an absolutely vital that we have an agenda or a theme for the meeting. And yet I find in Unhurried, when you don't set a theme, the theme takes care of itself. And we have wonderful connected conversations where by the end you can see several different themes have been raised, but you often find that they're all connected.
Do you ever learn something that really surprises you in these conversations?
I think the thing that continues to surprise me is how much people are willing to share about themselves. In a group of, I guess it's a group of friendly strangers. Mm. It creates a kind of intimacy that you might not get with people you know well. And it's not, obviously, it's not predictable, but I have sometimes done them where people have shared really heartfelt stuff, often about what's been a struggle or difficult for them in their life. Sometimes they're sharing stories of experiences which are absolutely hilarious that you might never have guessed. I often have the experience of sitting with a group of people and then being amazed by the stories of the lives that they've led. These apparently, and I'm putting sort of quotes around it, ordinary people turn out to have extraordinary lives.
I don't think there's such a thing as an ordinary person. I've discovered that with doing interviews and interviewing lots of people. I have this sense that you could go out into the street, pick somebody out at random, and if you ask them the right questions, you'll find out the most extraordinary things about them.
I think you're right. I think there's something... I feel slightly tearful even talking about it, because I think there's so much more to us than we realise in our frantic, hurried lives, where we have a culture that means we're quite prompted to tend to use each other. We buy things from each other. We're there to transact with each other. And I think we're missing a lot of the richness that's possible in our relationships with each other. And I think Unhurried gives us a little bit of a glimpse of what's possible.
It almost sounds therapeutic, actually, what you're talking about, for someone to go along and do this and listen and talk.
Some people do use that word to describe it. You know, we have regulars who say they find it therapeutic. And I understand what they mean. At least I think I do. I mean, I think it's comforting. I think it feeds a need for connection that isn't otherwise being met. And at the same time, the interesting thing is that there's very rarely any attempt by anybody in the conversation to kind of work on people or offer them solutions. The groups seem to understand that that's not what we're doing. We're not here to treat each other. So it's not like I would imagine a 12-step meeting to be. And I'm not for a moment suggesting there's anything wrong with those meetings. I understand that they're very powerful. This is different. So I think it feels like some people will use the word therapeutic to describe it, because the way I would interpret that is that it's a healing thing to be present to a conversation with people and find out what I sometimes feel like saying at the end, and it might sound slightly odd, is I come out sometimes thinking it turns out that we are enough for each other, that our experiences are enough. In a way, we may not need as much fixing as we think.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think this sounds like a fabulous, fabulous idea. Do you find that the group is growing and growing and growing?
It seems, I think it's sort of a settled, you know, as I said, 7 or 8 is at the low end, sometimes 15, occasionally 20. And it's gradually being picked up in other parts of the world, because people discover it online and have a chat to me about it, or occasionally a friend of mine somewhere else in the world has a go. So this process is now being run in Sydney once a month. A friend of mine is running in Bangalore in India. Another friend of mine runs one in Olympia, Washington. A friend who I met online through talking about this runs a group in Santa Cruz. A professional friend of mine has just started one in Ipswich. So in a very, very unhurried way, I think the idea is getting picked up in different parts of the world.
Is it just conversations, or do you think you could extend this to unhurried walks, unhurried cycle? You could almost have a franchise of this, really, couldn't you?
We have done a couple of unhurried walks, actually.
And have you?
It's a good reminder to me to do them again, because they were quite fun. And I have found, because I've been doing this for 5 years, I've kind of deepened my sense of what unhurried is. So in my work now, I am using this word unhurried in slightly different contexts. So in part of my professional life, I'm a tutor at the Side Business School at Oxford University, where I help them with running one of their leadership programs. And in my tutor group, I talk about unhurried leadership. And I've started writing about unhurried leadership, and not leadership in the sense of being some fantastic, heroic, charismatic figure, but really being what I sometimes call the reluctant leader, the person who feels that they're not perhaps qualified to do it, but no one else is volunteering, so I will. And so for me, the unhurried idea extended to leadership is a way of humanising the idea of leadership, so that you don't try to be a hero, because that often leads you actually to be a villain.
Yes.
In fact.
Yes.
It encourages you to bring more of your humanity to the work. And I guess Unhurried for me has been partly about slowing down enough to see other choices that we don't see when we're panicking. So if I extend it to leadership, it's or to my life, it's just slowing down enough to see more choices, realize I have more flexibility. I don't have to go on autopilot.
Yeah. No, I think this sounds great because I think we are becoming far too rushed in everything we do. There's no time to smell the roses, as they say. So how do people get in touch with you if they're interested in joining this group?
The easiest thing would be just, I think if you type Unhurried Cambridge into Google, it will take you to the website. Or if you want to type the website in, it's at meetup.com. If you search for it on meetup.com, you'll find Unhurried Cambridge there. And at the moment, we've got a date in the diary for the next one in a few days' time. And I drop them in roughly every couple of weeks. It's not always the same day of the week because we're trying to sort of cater for people who can come on some days and not others.
And one final question. When you're sitting there in your cafe, there must be people around you who are not part of this group and wondering what the heck's going on. Do you find that?
We're quite lucky in that it's where we go. It seems to be fairly quiet in the mornings. But funnily enough, no, I don't think people pay a great deal of heed. I think
they're probably too busy on their phones.
They might be dimly aware, but they're busy with their own conversations and lives.
Well, it sounds like a great idea, and I'm really, really pleased to speak to you, Johnny Moore. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Linda Ness talking to Johnny Moore.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
So, Linda, it's really interesting now. You've had another most influential woman on Women Making Waves.
I know. We really are finding them in droves, aren't we?
Yeah.
Priyanka Joshi. It was absolutely lovely. I found her because she was listed in the Vogue's Top 25 Most Influential Women in the UK.
I love those lists. I absolutely love searching those lists.
I know. They are absolutely great. And she does tell quite a funny story about the fact that she went to a photo shoot and she was there with Dua Lipa, who, to those who don't know, is quite a well-known pop star. I didn't have a clue who she was. And she was saying that her little sister was rolling her eyes and going, oh, for goodness sake, how could you not know who that was?
And she also met some amazing other ladies too. So she's had quite an experience already.
Other people on the list were J.K. Rowling, for example. Mm. And she was saying, you know, I grew up reading her books. So she was really taken by this as well. And she's absolutely lovely. So she tells the story of her life from when she was a young child in India.
So we'll be now listening to Dr. Priyanka Joshi talking to Linda Ness here at Women Making Waves.
A young girl would pick up a magazine and look at it and be like, okay, I could become an actor or a singer, but I could also become a scientist.
We are really fortunate on Women Making Waves to have access to women who are at the top of their field. During her PhD, Dr. Priyanka Joshi developed a small molecule library to target irregular proteins present in diseases such as Alzheimer's. Amongst other accolades, she's on the Vogue 25 list of the most influential women in the UK, alongside women such as Amal Clooney, J.K. Rowling, and Meghan Markle, and has been listed in the Forbes 30 Under 30 class of 2018. Tell me, Priyanka, how did you become a biochemist? Were you particularly interested in science as a child?
Oh, yes. I was born in India, in the capital, New Delhi. And I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, especially during the summer vacation. My maternal grandfather, he was not a scientist, but he had these little experiments in the backyard. So I remember him sort of encouraging, you know, us, like me and my cousins, and take us to this little workshop where he had a solar exhaust and, you know, a water turbine, and everything was more like an innovation. So I think that sort of sowed the seed of, you know, making new things and then seeing how they work. So that was the starting point. But there's another thing that happened. So in India, parents pressurize a lot on education.
Yes.
And, you know, you have to either become a doctor or an engineer. So when I was a kid, like, my father wanted to be a doctor. He could not become one. And everyone in the family thought that, you know, I'm going to become a doctor. And I also thought I should become a doctor. And then I fell sick an awful lot of times. So I was at the hospital with my parents every month. I had dengue, I had malaria, I had, you know, all sorts of these diseases when I was a kid. Although I was brought up very well. So my time at the hospital, like, every time I went there, I always wondered, like, you know, why do people get sick? And I thought doctors really solve this problem. They can help people, they can alleviate pain, suffering, and I just wanted to do that. But then as I grew up, I realized in my high school that a doctor definitely knows a lot about disease, But then a doctor is the one who gives you prescriptions, diagnoses the disease, but does not really understand the disease to a more molecular level. So there has to be someone else who looks at it. So I would say that one of my friends, her dad was a plant scientist, and he just encouraged me to study fundamental sciences. So I'm very glad that I got to meet him and then spoke to a lot of other people. And then I pursued basic sciences, and I was like, okay, I can still, you know, help people, but I have to sort of go back and do research. So I think that's when it started.
I remember when I was in India many years ago, seeing little children going to school along the street, and they were all beautifully dressed, beautifully kitted out, beautiful little dresses on, the girls' hair all tied back, little school bag, white socks. Absolutely perfect. You always got the impression they're going to be very, very keen to learn. Were you a good pupil at school?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. There were a lot of opportunities. So I would say I was blessed to go to a good school. I come from a middle class family, but my parents made sure that, you know, I went to a good school, and I was in an environment that encouraged, as in, there's no limit, just play, learn.
So you enjoyed your childhood?
Yeah. Yes.
What made you come to the UK?
So at some point during my undergraduation, I decided that if I have to do research, I need to get a PhD. And that's when I started applying for positions. As it happens is, if you're in India and if you want to go abroad, you have to write the GRE, which is an easy exam, but then it's more like you have to pay a lot of money to, you know, to sit with. And at that point, my parents were like, okay, we've helped you with your education, but we won't be able to pay more. So at that point, I was sort of in a dilemma whether to, you know, go for a regular job or to do a PhD, because nobody in my family comes from an academic background. No one has a PhD. So everyone thought that if you do a PhD, you need to essentially pay for it.
And presumably you'd done your master's by this time, so you'd already been studying quite a long time.
Yes, exactly. And my parents were like, oh my God, she has to go to the university. And my father often jokes even now, which is that I wouldn't generalize it for India, but in a middle class family, it's not very common to send their girls abroad just on their own. And my parents were already very, very brave to send me to a different city to, you know, study and be on my own while I was in India. But then when I told him that I want to do a PhD, he, of course, must have discussed with his colleagues. And one of his colleagues told him, don't send your daughter abroad alone. It'll be difficult to marry her off. So, and my father just laughed it off. So I'm very glad he did not take that advice seriously.
So you moved to the UK. Do you miss home? Do you go home quite a lot?
I do miss home. I do miss my parents. But thanks to technology, there's Skype, there's WhatsApp. I do feel that I'm so connected. So I miss home, but I do visit home at least once a year.
Mm-hmm. So and what about the marrying you off bit then? Have they got over that completely? Your dad wasn't too worried about that, was he?
Well, sometimes we do have this conversation, and they do look around and they're like, you know, we think we might have educated you too much or given you too much freedom. So what are your plans on getting married? And I'm like, well, it's going to happen when it happens. So, you know, I'm not going to force that on myself.
Yeah.
And I'd like if you don't force it on me as well. So, it's fine.
That's good. The best way to go, I would say. Mm-hmm. So you came here and you started studying your PhD. So tell us about the work in layman's terms, because, you know, not everyone will understand it. And I know it's really, really complex what you do.
Yes. So when I came to Cambridge, the group that I was working with essentially worked on neurodegeneration, and they worked on these proteins that aggregate, form clumps, and in diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So I was very excited because I always wanted to study neuroscience, but my background was not in neuroscience. So for me, it was like, okay, here is a position where I have all these prior skills in molecular biology and biochemistry that I have learned during my undergraduation. And I have a question that is so interesting, and I wanted to know more about neuroscience. So I think this is a perfect place to, you know, sort of learn so much more. So the question I was to look at was whether we can design small molecule drugs for these diseases. And we did not have an answer. So I'm very thankful to my supervisor, and I quite admire and look up to him, because he never told me what to do. He was like, so what are your ideas and how should we go about this? And I think that really helped in terms of that independence to think how I could solve that problem, given my understanding.
You weren't being fed answers.
Yes, exactly. So I think that was a great start. And because the problem was unsolved, which it's still unsolved. It's how it happens in science is like you build on incremental steps in knowledge and then you get closer and closer to the answer. So yes, that's how I started.
It wasn't Alzheimer's in particular. It was more the science behind it and the small molecules that,
yes,
that drew you to this.
Yes. But through my PhD, some interesting things happened. So I was diagnosed of a disease, which is glaucoma, which affects older people. And what really happens in glaucoma is that the nerve that connects your eye to the brain degenerates over time. This nerve sort of enables you to see. So if it degenerates, it's irreversible blindness. And I was diagnosed with it when I was 23. And that's very, very, very
that's
young to be
awful.
Diagnosed. Yes. So yeah. So when I was at Addenbrookes, the doctor was like, oh, my God, you're so just 23. You shouldn't be having it. So that was a turning point even for my work because I had to undergo some surgeries. And I did speak to the doctors at Addenbrookes a lot because I would ask them questions. Why, you know, why this, why that? And what are these drugs and everything? And to the point that I still have that letter in which at the end, the doctor has written, by the way, she's a biologist, you know, because I used to ask a lot of questions to him. So when I was reading up more about it, I just found like a link between glaucoma and Alzheimer's. I wouldn't say that people who have glaucoma will develop Alzheimer's or vice versa, but there is a link which we're not very certain about. I would call it like the irony, you know, I suffer from an ailment that people get in their old age and I work on it as well. So I think that sort of just kept me going, although it was a little difficult time because I had to take time off work and it was very difficult to concentrate because I could not see.
So you came up with a small molecule library. Was that something that you developed yourself or working with a team?
Yes. As things happen in science is that you don't work alone. You work in a big team. So it's work that everyone does together. So yes, we do have a team of people who I'm very fortunate to work with.
How did you feel when you were listed on Vogue's 25 Most Influential Women? That is quite an accolade. And the other people on that list, wow.
It was a surprise. I had no idea what was coming, to be honest.
How did you find out?
So I used to not do experiments during my PhD. I only started doing them afterwards. And I was doing this one experiment, which is called a Western blot. Essentially, it tells you if a protein has been expressed or not, so in a cell. And I was doing this and I get a call from Vogue, British Vogue. And I thought this is like a fake call, a spam call. Like, what is it?
You think it was one of your friends joking or something?
Yeah. And they said that we'd like to include you on this list of women. And would you like to come to London for a photo shoot? And initially I was like, okay, photo shoot, like I don't know what this is going to be all about. But then after a little thought, I was like, well, I like doing outreach. I love talking to children. I love talking to young people, you know, and motivate them and for science. And I even teach young children back in India over Skype. Like, I used to do that before. So I was like, this is also a form of outreach, just a different form of outreach. Mm. And British Vogue is one of these very popular magazines that a lot of girls pick up. And what you see is what you aspire to become, I feel. So when you see all these glamorous women on, you know, these covers, a lot of people might just aspire to become those. We don't see as many scientists on these. So I thought, oh, this might be a nice way to, you know, do a sort of outreach and reach out to younger girls. And at the same time, I'll also get to experience a photo shoot. I mean, who wouldn't want to go
with Vogue?
Exactly. So I said yes. And I went for the shoot. There were amazing people who I met there. Some women.
You were with Dua Lipa, weren't you?
Who's yes.
A famous pop star.
Yes. I'll confess, I did not know of her at that time. So I go and I'm like, hi, I'm Priyanka and I'm a scientist. And then she introduced herself and that was the only conversation we had. But I was just looking at her and I was like, she must be someone popular. So I go back and talk to my sister, who's 11 years younger to me. And I tell her and she's like, so in India, you would call it your elder sister as Didi. She's like, Didi, you don't know who Dua Lipa is. I was like, no. She's like, you must be really old then. No, the photo shoot was quite an experience. And until then, I still didn't know what was coming. So it was only when the list came out in June, I think the 1st of June, I started getting so many emails and I was like, what have I done? And when I saw the list, it's like, oh my goodness. So, I mean, I really look up to J.K. Rowling. I grew up reading Harry Potter and just seeing my name there. Yeah,
and it's a short list, 25 of you on that list.
Yeah.
So, amazing, really.
So I felt a lot of pressure as well. Pressure, and then I did not know what to do. And at the same time, I felt honored, humbled, but also responsible.
But it's great. I'm really, really glad that they aren't just focusing on actresses and people like that. They're actually including scientists.
Yes. And I think that is something that really got me to say a yes when I heard. I was like, British Vogue doing something so different. And they have, over the years, like, they've always tried doing something different, right? So I thought, here a young girl would pick up a magazine and look at it and be like, okay, I could become an actor or a singer, but I could also become a scientist.
And that's exactly what we want. I think STEM is becoming far more of an option for younger girls now. I'm hoping so anyway. Yeah. But it still needs all the help it can get, I think, in getting women into science. You list your pastimes as science outreach to kids, and you already mentioned this. What does that mean? What does that involve?
I'm interested in the extremes in terms of age. That means like younger kids and older people. So my research, I look at older people, but I love kids. I just love kids. I love playing with them. There's something about them, the way their brain develops and the way they ask questions and the way they're curious. So given my own experience, because I feel that when I was a kid, thanks to my grandparents and my parents who gave me all these experiences and opportunities, I was able to shape up my imagination. Mm-hmm. So I felt that I have to give back in some way. And that's the reason why I reach out to kids. It's that age when you can inspire them, motivate them.
Are you teaching science to them? Is that what you're doing?
So there's an organization in India called Evidya Loka. It's an online NGO. And what they do is like they partner online volunteers with students in villages in India. So I used to teach twice every week to a bunch of kids sitting in Jharkhand in India, which is a tiny village. Jharkhand is a state and there's a village in Jharkhand. And yes, I would wake up in the morning at 5 o'clock, switch on my laptop, and there in front of me were like about 20 to 25 kids, both boys and girls, sitting there looking up, ready to listen to what I had to teach
them.
And
were they a class or were they just individuals who got together because they were interested in science?
No, it was a class. So the idea was to teach them fundamental concepts, but not right from the textbooks. So you would basically explain the concepts to them.
I love the idea of you sitting in Cambridge and over the internet teaching a class in a village in India. That's a great idea.
Yes, and most of the children in my class were girls. For me, one of the very touching moments was when I was introducing some other friends to this so that they could volunteer as well. And the admin from India called me in and she said, you know, there's this girl who basically said that when I grow up, I want to become like Priyanka, ma'am. And I was like, oh, no, what have I done? Like, this is...
That's great. That's exactly what you want, because that inspires them.
Yeah.
Your other hobbies I see are experimental theatre and flamenco.
Ooh. Yes, I love dancing. I absolutely love dancing. So when I was in Cambridge and I was diagnosed with this glaucoma, and there was a period when I could not see. And, you know, when such things happen, the first thing you do is lose your confidence. Mm-hmm. It just goes down and you don't know what you're going to do.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, yeah. So what was terrifying for me was that if I can't see, what am I going to do with my life? And there was a period like 1 week when so in glaucoma, your eye pressures would go very, very high. And because of those eye pressures, I would not be able to see. So because I was terrified, I would just go off to sleep. And because I was like, you know, at least when I'm sleeping, there's no way to be fearful. So at that point, because I'd lost confidence, one of my best friends, she was in Switzerland at that point. She did flamenco and she said that, you know, why don't you try this? And I was like, okay, I'll go and try. And flamenco is, I mean, it is a partner dance as well in some forms of it. But essentially, when you start off on your own. And the more I did it, the more I felt connected to myself, as they say that music and dance can have this effect on you. Mm-hmm. So I just found a way to express myself, which was through flamenco, and I just loved it and got addicted. So, yes.
So what now? What research are you working in the moment?
So for me, I started off asking a question, which was, can we design small molecule drugs that can target these irregular misfolded proteins that cause Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? I would say that this was still more of a translational, you know, question where you're designing drugs for these proteins. I remember when I submitted my PhD, the first thought that came to my mind after I came out of that famous red door on Mill Lane was that now I know what I don't know. And I think that was the start. So I was like, I have to go back into asking a more fundamental question, which is that here I'm targeting these proteins that aggregate, form clumps and are implicated in Alzheimer's. But then what really causes them to aggregate? What really happens? What's the event that takes place that pushes these proteins to form clumps? So as we know that Alzheimer's presents itself about 20 years before the symptoms and before it's diagnosed or before it's picked up in the clinic, but we don't really know at that point that it has started. So of course there are genetic factors, there are familial factors where if, you know, it's hereditary and there's a 50% chance and one could get it. But what about people who just get it sporadically after 65 years of age? We don't understand why. So I asked that question and yeah, I started off with investigating metabolism. And metabolism essentially would give you a readout of your interaction with the environment, what's really happening around you. And if I could put it in very layman's words, it's like probably in the long term, an effect of how you're living, like your lifestyle, if that can contribute to the onset and progression of a certain disease or not. Mm-hmm. So what I'm investigating right now is certain metabolites whose levels change in response to a person's interaction with the environment. So your body is made up of small molecules as well, small molecules and these big molecules, and they work together to keep it in harmony. This interaction with the environment could cause the levels of some of these molecules to just change. So I'm trying to understand if these changed levels of these molecules, can it push these proteins to aggregate or not? Because if they do, then probably we'll get some answers to some other questions there.
Dr. Priyanka Joshi, thank you very much for joining us today and telling us, well, the story of your life, really. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was Linda Ness talking to Dr. Priyanka Joshi.
You're listening to Women Making Waves on Cambridge 105 Radio.
That's all we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves. We'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Priyanka Joshi, Joanna Bromwich and Johnny Moore. If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.